The mound were frightful. It began 150 feet from the wall, rose 30 feet in height, and ran 100 feet from one side of the gorge to the other. It was so vast that there was no sight of either the moat or the barbed wire barricade. Both were buried deep. This huge, stinking hill, more than anything else, slowed the endless horde in their attack. Painstakingly, they climbed to the top, only to be popped by one of the soldiers, their dead bodies adding to the mass. It was considered a good kill if the body fell back on the far side of the hill. Anything else only made the hill that much bigger, and many of the men began to wonder how big the hill would get before it broke like an ocean wave and collapsed on the wall and drowned them in corpses. Although it was a nightmare vision, it was an unlikely possibility. The greatest numbers of the undead were already overflowing the smaller hills, hemming in the road, and of course they were surging up the Big Thompson. The river was Gray's sole responsibility. His command, the 7th Company, 2nd Battalion, comprised of 108 men, had one of the most dangerous zones. The mountain river with its frigid waters sapped the strength of the men. Their hands grew quickly numb, causing their aim to suffer. They quickly lost feeling in their feet, and they stumbled frequently among the slippery rocks that lined the bottom. To Gray, it felt as though someone had cobbled the riverbed with skulls, and there wasn't one among them who wasn't soaked up to their necks. The fires that Sadie kept going helped to a degree. It wouldn't be true to say that she worked tirelessly. It was the opposite, really. The girl's breath huffed in and out as she dragged her feet up and down the hills, searching for branches and sticks. Her face and hands were scratched and her black shirt torn, but still she went at it nonstop. She needed help, but no one had come, despite Gray's demands. His own soldiers were in no shape to help. Every hour they'd come slogging out of the river to throw themselves down in front of the fires. They thrust their frozen limbs toward the flames and could do nothing but shake for their 15 minutes of rest. They would then rotate to the south hill, where the last of the sun's rays would add a final touch of warmth, before they crossed over to take their turn at the north hill, where, in true Colorado fashion, it was 20 degrees colder in the shade. It was a taste of things to come. More than anything, Gray feared the sun setting. With the surrounding peaks so tall, evening came early to the valley. When it did, the sudden temperature drop would only add to the misery of the men. Of course, worse than that would be the dark itself. He knew that the monsters would be 10 times harder to kill when they appeared to be nothing but moaning shadows against a black background. Fires just behind the lines would have to be kept going all night long, and one girl, no matter how tough, wouldn't be enough. For 2 straight hours, Gray kept moving, going from platoon to platoon, sometimes encouraging the men, sometimes fighting alongside them, and infrequently stopping at the radio. When it was answered, which was only about half the time, he would scream demands at whoever was on the other end of it. His company was getting desperate for ammunition. It was flying downrange at a ridiculous rate. When 2,000 rounds had been expended, Gray turned from the fight to stare back in the direction of the valley, hoping to see someone, anyone, coming. But the pine-studded hills were barren of life, all save for the storm crows, who watched the fight in a moody silence, waiting for their chance to feed. They had been eating well, these crows. They were plump as partridges, and struggled to gain altitude when they bothered to fly. "Son of a bitch!" Gray swore as the sound of an explosion jerked his head to the north. A grenade, he hoped. It would be a bad sign if a mortar crew was working already. When no further explosions were added to the first, and there was only the ongoing tat-tat-tat of distant gunfire, he relaxed the tiniest bit. There were a total of 5 gun battles going on. 3 were large affairs, like at the Big Thompson, and 2 were smaller brush-ups where rarely a dozen guns would get into the mix. There would be more battles, he knew. The longer the soldiers fought the undead to a standstill in the larger valleys, the more the smaller, finger-like gullies branching off of them would fill up. Each would have to be held, each defended, each a drain on their supplies. If Sadie was correct and the numbers of zombies exceeded 250,000, then there was going to be a simple problem of math that the people of the valley were going to run into. According to the quartermaster, they had just above 80,000 rounds of 5.56 ammunition, 6,000 of the fast-flowing 7.62 ammo used by the heavy machine guns, and another 10,000 or so rounds of various calibers for the very wide assortment of civilian weapons. The deficit was worrisome. Every bullet had to count. His men simply could not afford to miss. With this on his mind, Gray waded into the rising river. When the fight had begun, the waters had been an inch or two above his knee. Now, after they had built a veritable dam of bodies stretching all the way across the river, the water was at his diaphragm.
"Men," he bellowed over the sound of the guns, "move up! Get as close as you can get!"
They had been shooting at a distance of about 50 yards, and had it not been for the icy water and their numb hands, and the fact that their targets were the size of melons and were constantly in motion, the men could hardly miss. But given these factors, only half their shots were striking home. It was unacceptable. Gray led the way, pushing deeper and deeper until the freezing water was just below his nipples. The water was so cold that it physically hurt. He moved right up to the mound of dead bodies that the stiffs were struggling over and shot the first one from point-blank range.
"Keep them on the other side. Make this our line, men. Don't let any get by."
His men, their teeth chattering and holding their guns out of the water, drew up in a new line stretching across the water and began firing. They were, as always, very thorough and professional, not wasting a bullet, and just as important, they didn't waste any energy bitching about the cold or their crap assignment. They called a target, fired, pressed the warm stock of their weapons to their face for a moment, called another target, and fired again. When he saw that his men were well in hand, he splashed the shore to find that help had finally arrived in the form of Neil Martin. For some strange reason, Neil had changed out of the ill-fitting BDUs he had been wearing and was back to jeans, a denim shirt, and a bright yellow sweater vest. The only nod that he gave to the fact that they were at war was that he still had on his jungle boots and had not gone back to wearing the fruity Crocs. He waved at Gray as if this was a chance meeting during a nature walk. Thankfully, he wasn't alone. Behind him in a long line were 40 civilians, an equal mix of men and women, each weighed down with boxes or bags. Gray was happy to see that the majority of it was ammo. The rest was food and water. Neil nodded judiciously at the 4-platoon rotation setup and then pointed at the brisk battle going on and said,
"Very good. Looks like you have the situation in hand."
Gray found himself frowning. Something was different about Neil. It was in the way he was looking at Gray, as though he expected some sort of explanation or report. The strangeness was also in the way the other civilians were looking at Neil, like he was something new and not the same quiet man who had been all over the valley during the last week, walking with Sadie or just picking flowers. They were looking at him with a mixture of confusion and awe.
"I suppose we're doing okay,"
Gray answered.
Jauntily, Neil said, "Good. I've brought you some volunteers. What do you need of them?"
The captain shot a puzzled glance at the civilians before he asked,
"You brought volunteers?"
Neil had been one of the quietest people in the valley. It seemed unlikely that he could round up anyone besides a few of the renegades they had come in with. There were only two in the group: Connie Markson, a brave and steadfast woman, and William Gates, who was giving Gray a hard look. William's sister-in-law, Mary Beth Gates, had been going downhill steadily since their arrival. There were no actual doctors in the valley. The closest thing they had was an ex-emergency room nurse, who was in way over her head when it came to Mary Beth's case. Gray could offer little advice except to pump her full of fluids, morphine, and antibiotics, and then pray for all they were worth. One thing Gray knew was that another surgery would mean her death. In the last week, Gray had little time to visit Mary Beth, which was a sore spot with the family. He gave William a curt nod before turning back to Neil.
"We need these people, too,"
he started to say. However, Neil interrupted him.
"My people, you mean?"
"Is there something going on that I should know about?"
Gray asked.
"You haven't heard? I've been appointed the interim acting governor of Estes Valley. General Johnston stepped down this afternoon. He's still in charge of the military, but he answers to me, and, before you ask, yes, it's weird."
This brought a chuckle from Gray.
"I'd say that it was more than weird. It's downright strange. But I guess it is what it is, and it doesn't affect our current situation or our current needs. We need wood, lots of it. It'll be dark soon, and we'll need to light a fire. If we can't keep fires going, this position will be untenable, and we'll need more food and ammo."
Neil nodded and clapped his hands together like an eager basketball coach.
"Okay, you heard the captain. Divide yourself into 4 squads of 10 people each. We're going to need one group to go back to the valley and get a bunch of chainsaws and axes. The other 3 squads will start scrounging for dead wood. Let's get moving."
They moved out smartly, without the least grumbling. William looked as though he wanted to say something to Gray, but thankfully Neil pulled the soldier aside.
"You know about the ammo issue, correct?"
Neil only allowed Gray to dip his head once before he went on.
"If Sadie's right about the numbers, we're going to be in serious trouble."
"She is right," Gray replied. "If I had to guess on how this will play out, the Aziel will sap our strength using the Horde. It'll be 3 or 4 days of endless zombie attacks followed by a military strike. Though my biggest fear is what they have in surprise for us. Remember what Brad said about their military having toys, too? I'm praying that they're pinning their hopes on tanks. They would be practically useless in this mountain terrain. Gunships would be bad. A good helicopter pilot would be able to use the hills to devastating effect. Artillery would also..."
"We can't worry about that just yet,"
Neil said, interrupting.
"The truth is, if we run out of ammunition, none of that will matter."
There was indeed truth in that. A deadly truth.
"I need your advice, Gray. Do we just keep going as we are and hope there are fewer zombies than we have bullets?"
"I think we can't stake our existence on hope. We're going to have to deal with this old school. Have some of your people scrounge up baseball bats, hammers, sledgehammers, spears, swords, tire irons, and machetes. Basically anything that can be swung to deadly effect. We're going to have to go toe to toe."
Neil leaned in close and asked,
"What about our artillery? Shouldn't we use it?"
The soldier shook his head.
"Only in an emergency. We only have so many rounds, and it's best to save them."
"Then it will be hand-to-hand combat," Neil said, and then clapped Gray on the shoulder. "Good luck here."
Gray punched Neil in the arm as though they were brothers.
"You keep your luck. You're going to need it as governor."
Neil started to leave, but Gray grabbed him by the back of the sweater vest.
"And do me a favor. Take Sadie back to the valley. She's run herself into the ground."
Neil started to turn away, and Gray spun him back a second time.
"How's Deanna?"
Gray asked, his voice pitched low.
"Tell me she's somewhere safe."
"She is. I've appointed her to my one-person staff. I thought about bringing Sadie on board, but I know that she would just get frustrated at how people are, and then she'd start threatening them with her pistol. That's a bad precedent to set."
With a grin, Gray asked,
"What about Fred Trigg? You know that if he's not on your staff, in other words, if he's not safe and warm, he's going to make life hell for you."
"I should send him here,"
Neil said, looking out at the soldiers who were shooting zombies at point-blank range. Neil went a touch green at the sight of the blood spraying and the rotting brains splattering and the ugly waterlogged mound of corpses where arms and legs stuck out at odd angles, and the pooled river water which was dark red. Even the shoreline where the soldiers crawled out onto dry land was stained maroon with old blood.
Please don't, for our sakes, Gray said. This is the River Styx already. No sense in making it worse.
The name, the River Styx, had been overheard, and it stuck. The water was hell, but it got worse when the first delivery of melee weapons arrived. There were three basic weapon types at hand. The bludgeoners, your baseball bats, your tire irons, your basic cudgels. These crushed skulls, turning them to pulp. Then there were the bladed weapons. Axes, machetes, and in one case, an actual saber. It was a terrible weapon. The blade of the saber started dull, and it only became more so every time a skull was struck. The last type, Gray labeled as miscellaneous, an African spear with a metalled tip was found. Four stout table legs with long screws were provided. Three poles with metal tips were stripped of their flags and hauled down the river, and lastly, a number of lengths of copper pipes were in use. These were odd weapons in that they clanged with a disjointed musical sound every time they struck a skull just right. Eventually, as night fell, and each man had his gun traded for a melee weapon, the battle became surreal. Gray figured it had to be the quietest battle in the history of war. On one side, the enemy came on in an eternal moan, a long, soulless, haunting sound that was enough to shiver the heart of the hardest warrior. On the other side of the fight came the grunt of men too tired to speak. Their work went on hour after weary hour. As a plus, wielding melee weapons the way they were was hard exercise, and they were able to bear the near-freezing temperatures better than they had. As a negative, death was so, so close. At best, it was just over an arm's length away. Sometimes it was inches away. Gray shared the fate of his men. Wherever the fighting was thickest, he would charge into battle wielding the saber that had been passed from man to man, each quickly discovering that the blade was too dull for the job of killing in a quick strike. Whenever he took a break, Gray honed the blade endlessly. The fight was deadly to friend and foe alike. Even on the sloping hills above the river, it wasn't easy. Each man had to rely on the man higher up on the hill, as they soon grew too tired to strike at any angle other than downwards. It took nerves of steel to ignore the creature coming at them with their mouth agape and their teeth slashing in. Still, nothing beat the river for outright terror. No fire could be built behind the line of men, and with the dark, the creatures were horrifying shadows that suddenly morphed into real terrors, always just within reach. Gray fought here exclusively. Hours went by, and every stroke of the saber was a torture for him. His soaking wet uniform clung to his body, pulling tight to his arms and shoulders, restricting his swings, and adding what felt like 50 pounds to his body. He slogged back and forth through the river, fighting until his muscles ached. By the time the moon finally peaked over the mountain, he was thinking he wouldn't be able to go on much longer. And then a scream erupted. So far, there had been a few angry shouts and some curses at near misses, mixed with the moans of the undead, but they were infrequent. The scream was blood-curdling. It snapped Gray's head around. He was standing where he had thought the line was the weakest, where the men needed him most. He was wrong.
Chapter 8. Private First Class Paul Wesley. The battle at the River Styx became a test of human endurance, both physically and mentally. It was beyond medieval. It was an endless slaughter punctuated by what felt like the briefest respite spent in front of a fire. These respites weren't long enough to make a dent in the exhaustion of the men. All the men were feeling the strain except, of course, for Captain Gray, who was in the thick of every battle. He seemed to spend half his time in the river, swinging the saber until it went as dull as a butter knife, and began to bounce off the skulls of the undead. He would then look at his weapon as if it were an old friend who had betrayed him by not keeping up with his inhuman pace. PFC Wesley could commiserate with the sword. He was sure he wasn't going to keep up the frantic pace of the fight. He had seen nothing like it. The stiffs slithered and crawled over the mound in a relentless wave of gray bodies, and always they came at the soldiers mouth first, showing their cracked and fissured teeth. It was the stuff nightmares were made of. Things had been bad when they had first started banging away with their M4s. The killing was ugly, and the red-brown water they stood thigh-deep in had been worse. Then the captain had ordered them forward so that the killing was up close in living color. That had been much worse. What was much, much worse was when they had been told to switch out their guns for sticks and hunks of metal.
"What the hell?"
Wesley whispered to the man next to him, a tall ginger with a drooping nose like the beak of a parakeet.
"They don't expect us to fight with this stuff."
The ginger's name was Kozlowski. He stood a head taller over Wesley, who was built along the lines of a fire hydrant. Kozlowski, who went by the abbreviation Kaz, bent low to speak into Wesley's ear.
"Trust the captain. He knows what he's doing. He's probably conserving ammo."
That was a scary thought. In Wesley's mind, conserving ammo equated to a shortage of ammo. When it was his turn to pick from the remaining weapons, he jumped at the opportunity to take one of the table legs. It seemed to be the sturdiest of the rather pathetic weapons arrayed before them. His friend Kaz grabbed an aluminum bat that seemed to have been made for a little leaguer and had asked in a beggy sort of whisper to trade. Wesley wished he had. The table leg had been the better weapon, at first. It was so heavy that it could cave in a skull with ease. Unfortunately, the weight of it had a serious drawback. After an hour, Wesley was gasping for breath and his arms felt like they were weighed down by lead. The 5-inch screws jutting out of the head of the weapon had a bad habit of snagging either in the remains of clothing or in the loose skin of the zombies, causing Wesley to have to expend as much energy pulling the weapon free as he did in the initial strike. On top of that, each time he hit home with his weapon, it bit into his frozen hands until he had blisters growing on top of his blisters. His grip on the table leg grew weaker and weaker, and he was forced time and again to step back and ask his friend Kaz to cover him as he readjusted his hands on the awkward hunk of wood. With its beveled edge and its gentle curve, it was just not designed to be wielded as a weapon. Kaz didn't understand. He would step up because they were friends, but he would do so with a look. It was a look that nagged at Wesley as much as his running blisters. They were soldiers of the valley, and that was supposed to mean something. It was why Wesley went at it long after he should have asked to be pulled from the line. His pride was greater than his pain and weariness. It was so great that it ended up killing him.
"How much longer till we switch?"
he asked Kaz through chattering teeth. Whenever they were in the river, it felt like time slowed to a crawl.
8 minutes,
Kaz gasped before pounding a zombie in the head. The first blow stunned the creature and dented its skull. It took a second blow to send shards of bone into the thing's near-useless brain. Wesley took his own swing at yet another zombie, the impact nearly jarring the table leg out of his frozen fingers. When he looked down at his hands, they seemed welded into the clawed position needed to hold the wood. He tried to straighten the right one out, but it wouldn't bend.
"Fuck!"
he said as he waited on the next stiff. With the mound being so large now, they came every 5 seconds or so. The next one, however, was fast, and it was there in two. It was also a particularly virile-looking zombie, and yet Wesley felt no fear. Part of his lack of fear was exhaustion, which deadened his emotions, and part was the knowledge that no matter how big it was just a stiff.
It was nothing to fear, as long as Wesley stuck to his training and his natural skills. It crawled over the pile of bodies, crabbing eternally on, pushed forward by the relentless force of those behind and drawn by its greedy hunger. Wesley took aim and swung the table leg. The swing bore little resemblance to his first swing, which had been a Babe Ruth-like home run swing. This swing was halting, and because of the ache in his hands and his exhaustion, it lacked the finishing power. Worse, it was ill-aimed. The pile of corpses was uneven, and a 3-inch drop was all the difference between a perfect hit square on the top of the cranium and a miss with deadly repercussions. The leg glanced off the temple of the beast, tore its ear half off before the screws jutting from the varnished wood bit good and hard into the zombie's shoulder. The strike hurt Wesley far more than it did the zombie. Pain zinged up his wrists, loosening his grip even more. And thus it took only a spasming buck from the beast to wrest the table leg from his hands. For the moment he was weaponless. This didn't cause the scream that had Gray lunging through the water as fast as he could push his exhausted body. Unlike so many cowards outside the valley who wore the uniform but who owed their continued existence to running and hiding, Wesley was a real soldier, a veteran of countless battles against what he felt like infinite numbers of undead. His main weapon might have been wrested from his grip, but he wasn't close to being panicked. Quick as a wink, his right hand went for his K-bar. It was out, flashing silver in the weak light of the fires that the civilians were keeping alight just behind the lines. With confidence born of skill and experience, he sunk the 7-inch blade up to the hilt right into the temple of the zombie. It struck home with a solid thunking sound as bone gave way to the sharpest metal.
"Cover me, Kaz,"
he said with an almost casual air to his friend, because why wouldn't he be casual? Hadn't he fought this fight in one of its many permutations 100 times before? The icy river was different, but his exhaustion was familiar, and the zombie with its gray skin and the foul, evil hunger in its eyes was ever unchanging. He had been here before, and he expected to be here 10 years hence, doing the same thing, killing so that others could live free. Yet this time was different, and he was the last to realize it. Again there was a casualness to him as his left hand went to the forehead of the zombie to pull the blade free. Only as he extended his hand, he saw that he had, for the first time, missed his mark. By some quirk or by some slight movement of the beast or some unforeseen shift in the pile of dead or some evil intrigue brought upon him by the constantly moving water of the river, the blade had not pierced the thin bone of its temple. Instead, it had traveled through the thing's ear at a downward angle to come out below its jawline. What would have been debilitating to any human barely fazed the zombie. For all intents and purposes, the blade had all the effect on the zombie as if Wesley had stuck a feather in its ear. Where Wesley was slowed by confusion and the drag of many hours of fighting in the line, the zombie was just as full of its vile vigor as when it first woke in its undead state. It grabbed Wesley's left hand with both of its hands, and before Wesley knew it, 3 of his fingers were in the thing's mouth, and ragged, diseased teeth were crushing down with unstoppable power. The pain was sharp. Unbelievably sharp. However, the realization that he was now a dead man was what caused him to come unglued. He pulled his hand away, saw the raw stumps, and simply lost it. His mind blanked, and he reacted. Reacting was one of those things his captain had long preached against. A soldier reacting to his environment was a soldier one step behind. A soldier 1 second too late. Captain Gray preached making the enemy react to you. Wesley was too far gone down the roads of panic and exhaustion. He pulled his hand away, inadvertently yanking the zombie toward him. It came down off the mound with a splash and promptly disappeared. The waters, once clear and clean, were now a murky soup of blood, chunks of zombie, and half-submerged corpses.
"It's in there!"
Wesley screamed at the top of his lungs.
"It's in there somewhere!"
He tried to run, but his foot slipped on the round, slimed-over rocks, and he sunk up to his chin, which only had his spasming worse. He could think of nothing except getting away. The soldiers around him were also backing away from the thrashing man in the turbulent waters. A zombie under the water was a dangerous thing. It was likely turned around or upside down and would bite the first thing it came in contact with. Four men backing from the line would doom their position if things weren't fixed quickly. Just at that moment, Wesley didn't care about the line. There was a zombie in the water, and it was worse than any shark that had ever lived. As he struggled to get away, he ran into Captain Gray, who picked him up out of the water with one hand.
"What the hell's going on?" he growled.
"There's a zombie in the water,"
Wesley said. He went to point, but the stumps of his fingers drew all of his attention, and he could only gape at his hand, his mind tipping over. The other soldiers were pointing in the general direction of where Wesley had been standing. Gray barked,
"There's going to be a dozen of them in the water if you don't do your jobs."
Dropping Wesley, he stabbed his saber into the riverbed, pulled the M4 off his back, and shot it 6 times at the slithering undead crawling over the mound. 6 more corpses were added to the mound. He then reslung the weapon and rearmed himself with the saber. Boldly, he stepped forward, running the sword through the water until it struck something meaty.
"Here it is,"
he said, lifting the zombie out of the water. He had speared it under the armpit, and now it wiggled at the end of the metal as it tried to thrust itself further onto the sword to get at Gray. It was a hideous sight. Wesley found himself unable to look away, unable to think past the terrible fact that the zombie had his fingers in its belly. He had the irrational thought that they were still good, and that all it would take to reattach them was to snap them back in place.
"Kaz!" Gray snapped. "What are you waiting for? Kill this thing!"
"Careful of its stomach!"
Wesley hissed. Its stomach. That's where his fingers were, of course. Kaz stepped forward and brought the dented-up aluminum bat down with one vicious stroke and stove in the thing's head. Without regard to the fingers that were likely still wriggling inside of it, Gray flung the now-dead zombie into the river.
"Get back in line, men! And let's try to keep our heads on straight. We don't want to frighten the civilians with—"
He stopped in mid-sentence as he saw Wesley's bleeding hand. Gray's hard look softened at once, and he whispered,
"Oh, holy hell."
"I'm so sorry,"
Wesley said, suddenly realizing that not only had he lost his fingers, he had let his captain down.
"I didn't mean it, sir. I missed. The table leg got caught, and then the knife—"
"Hey, don't worry about that stuff now,"
Gray said, gently taking Wesley's arm. He began to lead Wesley out of the water, but Wesley stopped and pointed at the corpse.
"It still has my fingers. We should get them back."
"Let's get you to the fire first, and then I'll go back and get them."
"But it's not yet time for the fire, sir,"
Wesley replied, stopping again. Now that the finger-eating zombie was dead, Wesley was beginning to feel like himself again, all except for the shakes that had entered his chest and limbs. It was adrenaline at having such a close call, he told himself, and not the virus.
"I need to get back in the line. It's not fair to everyone else that I get to go warm up early. In fact, I should be pulling a double for messing up. That's what I'll do."
He started to pull back from Gray's grip, but his captain was far too strong.
"No, let's get you to the fire."
Wesley was propelled to one of the fires where the civilians rested when they had a moment. There was only a single girl at the fire, and she seemed dressed in shadows.
Only her pale face stood out from her dark clothes. She had been looking sleepy. However, when she saw it was Captain Gray coming, she perked up.
"We're going to be pulled out of the line in 2 hours and given a 6-hour rest. 12th Company is going to take our place."
"Our place?" Gray asked. "Since when did you join the army?"
As he spoke, he helped Wesley down. Out of habit, Wesley stuck his hands out to the fire. The left, with its three little stumps dripping blood, fascinated him to such a degree that he could barely follow what was going on around him. The two spoke for a bit. Then there was a long quiet, and then the girl seemed concerned with Wesley, and his captain asked if he was in pain.
"I don't feel anything, sir,"
Wesley answered, hiding his hand close to his body.
"It's the cold water. I just need a couple of minutes to warm up, then I'll be good to go."
"Get him some food and water,"
the captain said to the girl. Wesley shook his head.
"No food. I don't want any food. And just a sip or two of water. I don't need any more than that. It should last me until..."
Wesley stopped speaking abruptly. He was having the darndest time coming to grips with what was happening to him. His mind was swirling with images of the zombie and its grinning mouth and the blood, his blood in its teeth. The image kept coming over and over again. Then he would lift up his hand and wiggle the little stumps.
"How am I going to fight?"
he asked his hand at one point. He felt like he was cracking up. Time was getting away from him as well. And at one point he looked up from his hand and found himself alone at the fire. At another point, the girl was suddenly there with a water bottle filled with brown liquid.
"Hot cocoa,"
she said. He tried to push it away.
"I have to go,"
he told her.
"I'm needed in the line."
She shoved the bottle at him, and there was an edge to her voice when she said,
"Drink it. Those are your orders."
It was good, and the heat of it went right to his heart. He hid his mangled hand from himself by stuffing it into his BDU blouse. He thought he was ready to go and looked around for Captain Gray in order to demand to be sent back to the line. There was a constant motion all around him. Civilians, long lines of them, came and went. They carried heavy burdens, wood and wiring, boxes and crates. They were everywhere. But for what seemed like ages, there was no sign of Captain Gray. Finally, he came back, carrying a man across his shoulders. When he laid the man down, Wesley leaned back away from him with a gasp. The soldier's face was half eaten away. His nose was nothing but a bloody hole. He was missing an eye, and his right cheek had been torn off so that an entire row of teeth were visible.
"Who is this?"
Gray was demanding. At first, Wesley thought his captain was asking him, and so he tried to make out the mauled soldier's features, but found it impossible. But Gray wasn't talking to him. The captain was on the radio.
"Horner, this is Red River Leader. Where's the goat man? I need to talk to him."
There was a pause in which the chewed-up soldier breathed out bubbles of blood, and then Gray was speaking again.
"This is Red River Leader. I need eyes on my position, ASAP.
The radio crackled.
4 minutes.
In those 4 minutes, two more men were brought to the fire. Although neither seemed bloodied in any way, they both looked like they were at death's door. They were uniformly white, had listless, glazed-over eyes, and both shook from head to toe. One was Wesley's friend Kaz, and the other was a sergeant from 3rd Platoon named Renfro.
"Hypothermia," Kaz said. "I'll be as good as new in a few minutes. I just need something for this headache."
Renfro shook his head.
"Ain't no hypothermia. Where as fucked as this guy?"
He gestured at the man who was missing most of his face. Wesley's eyes lasered in on Renfro's hand. In the webbing between the thumb and index finger, there was blood and ragged loose skin where a number of blisters had formed one over the other, each bursting and then tearing away until there was no more skin to tear. Renfro was bleeding. Kaz looked at his own hands. He was bleeding as well.
It doesn't mean anything, Wesley said. You may not be infected. I'm not, and I'm worse than any of you.
Renfro and Kaz looked away and said nothing.
I'm not infected,
Wesley insisted. The poor guy stretched out on the ground was certainly infected, and Renfro sure looked like he was turning a shade of gray beneath his pallor. But Kaz was always very white, and Wesley felt fine. Yes, his hand had begun to thrum, and sharp pains had started to shoot up in his temples, and he was beginning to sweat, but none of that meant he was infected.
I'm fine,
he said, when the silence around the fire had carried on for too long. He held up his left hand, which still trickled blood. He thought that was a good sign. It was washing away the germs.
I'm a righty anyway. I don't need a left hand to kill the stiffs. Kaz, can I borrow your bat?
Kaz stared around with his washed-out eyes until he saw the bat sitting in a bush a few feet away. He reached for it as Renfro buried his head in his hands and groaned in pain. Before Kaz could hand it over, there was a blare of lights that had the three lucid soldiers cringing. The light seemed to carry with it needles of fire that burned right into the stem of their eyes.
Turn that shit off! Renfro screamed.
A dark figure, like a 10-foot-tall demon, stalked toward them, its face filled with rage. Wesley grabbed the bat and brought it back, only before he could swing it, a hand caught his arm. It was the captain.
Careful, Wesley.
He nodded at the demon, and now Wesley saw it wasn't a demon at all. It was General Johnston, and his face was far from angry. He looked sad.
Let's move these men back to the valley, the general said in a tone so low it was hard to pick out over the crackling fire.
The captain agreed with a nod.
For their sake and for the morale of the others. It's the river, sir. The water is not just as cold as ice. It's also diseased. It has become a pool of filth, and perhaps worse, it's rising. Every stiff we kill adds to the dam, which then adds to the height of the water. I have men trying to fight with the water up to their armpits. It's treacherous.
And your suggestion?
M240s, Gray said. We can set them up at head height on the riverbanks.
Johnston drew in a sharp breath at the suggestion.
I can't authorize that, I'm sorry. We have less than 4,000 rounds left. It has to be preserved in case of a general attack by the Aziel. Is there any way we can continue a defense with hand weapons?
Gray shrugged.
Of course, but we can expect a very heavy casualty rate. These men aren't accustomed to these sorts of weapons. Kozlowski, hold up your hands. You see, it's just blisters. Any cut or scratch is a death sentence. We have to change tactics.
Then we use the big guns,
Johnson concluded. Now it was Gray's turn to look skeptical, to which Johnston said,
We're out of choices. Mortars won't cut it in the river. The water will absorb too much of the force of the explosions. They'd be a waste, and we don't have a large enough stockpile of 7.62 rounds to make a difference. It wouldn't last an hour. It has to be artillery. A few rounds will decimate them and buy us some time.
Wesley watched the exchange with little comprehension. He understood the deadly nature of the virus as well as anyone. However, he just couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that the deadly germs could have possibly entered his system. After all, he had fought the beasts for so many long months. There had been a dozen times he had gone into battle with cuts or scratches, and he had always been fine.
We don't need artillery,
he declared to both of the officers. His headache was making him cranky, and the way they were both tap-dancing around the real issue was annoying.
What we need is for men to step up.
He snatched up Kaz's bat and brandished it.
We need to keep fighting like we're trained to do.
He started marching off toward the river when Captain Gray magically appeared at his side.
Wesley, no. We have plenty of men for the job. You need to rest.
Wesley could not admit to himself what everyone else knew, at least not on a conscious level. It was his subconscious that was the cause of the tears that ran down his face, unnoticed.
"I'm fine. I really am," he said. "Fine enough to crack a few skulls."
The laugh that accompanied this was burdened by a sob which he couldn't explain. He pulled his arm from Gray's strong grip and pleaded,
"Let me do my job."
Gray stared for a moment, and then put a hand on Wesley's shoulder.
"Okay, soldier. Do your duty."
"Thanks," Wesley gushed. "You can count on me."
"I know I can."
The officer watched him for a second, and then turned to General Johnston and practically ordered,
"Spin up the artillery."
For reasons Wesley could not understand, he felt an urgent need to get back into the line before the artillery struck home. He went straight away for the river, though he had no idea if this was where his platoon was. He simply knew that was where the fighting was the hardest, and he was a warrior in his heart. With the bat cocked, he waded in with a battle cry that screamed out of his soul. It was filled with anger and sorrow and the pain that had built up inside of him. The bat was so easy compared to the table leg. It clanged off of skull after skull, sending strange vibrations up his arm. It was so easy to kill with it that Wesley understood how Kaz had formed blisters so quickly. The bat was light enough to wield without tiring. He had clubbed down a dozen stiffs, and all around him the unknown soldiers had backed away in awe of the one-handed soldier. When the first of the 105mm shells ripped through the night sky with what sounded to Wesley like a rebel yell, he joined in. 100 yards downstream, the shell exploded 50 feet above the surface of the river in a tremendous fireball. The soldiers in the river hunkered down in the foul soup of blood and fleshy chunks. Wesley did not. His battle cry rang out in the gaping silence that followed. There were still zombies to kill, and there was still time to kill them. Not much time, it felt, but enough. Shell after shell screamed overhead, landing with pinpoint accuracy in the river, changing forever its course and composition. Great hollows and deep pools were dug in seconds, and for years afterwards they were lined with the shards of millions of pale bones. Wesley gloried in the destruction. He felt as though he had reached some sort of peak in his life, and he strove with all his dwindling strength to retain the feeling, because on some level he knew the feeling would be fleeting. And it was. He was witness to 20 explosions of epic proportions, and in that time he killed 30 of the beasts. He was standing on the dam of the dead, exhausted, breathing out great gasps and wondering why his head was splitting and his arms were as heavy as downed tree trunks when he saw streaks in the sky. They were lines of fire, but they were heading the wrong way. They were heading towards the valley. His eyes tracked the progress of the streaks until they disappeared behind the far hill, and then there was a pause, followed by a flash of light and a distant rumble.
"Shit,"
he whispered. Even with his head pounding like the worst hangover he had ever experienced, he knew what the lights had been. Counter-battery fire. The Aziel had waited with unexpected patience to unleash their own artillery, and now they were filling the Estes Valley with deadly shrapnel. Wesley waited for the answering shots from his side, but there were none. The Aziel fired round after round without a single shot in response.
"They're all dead,"
he whispered. He could picture the burned-out wreckage of the valley's 4 guns. He could almost smell the charred flesh. Unbelievably, he felt a sudden pang of hunger.
"Fuck that,"
he raged. Although the artillery had practically vaporized the entire horde of zombies flowing up the Big Thompson, there were still a few hundred to take care of. Private First Class Paul Wesley
planted his feet on the dam of corpses. At that time it was horribly impressive in its dimensions. It ran the length of the gorge cut out by the river and was as wide as a four-lane highway. He stood in its direct center and swung his bat one-handed, cursing in a screeching voice. His head felt like it was about to split wide open, but at least he was warm. The zombie fever baked the chill of the river right out of him. It made him numb to everything except the desire to do his duty. He wasn't going to let his fellow soldiers down again, no matter what. No matter that there were zombies all around his legs, feasting on his flesh. That didn't matter. The only thing that mattered to him was making sure no one else would die that night. Chapter 9. Chili Bean. As night fell, the Aziel grew as eager as children on Christmas Eve. They sensed that victory was only hours away, and they went about grinning or rubbing their hands greedily. Their tremendous zombie hordes had been whipped and kicked and pushed up the twin highways leading to Estes. This undead army was unstoppable, invincible. Their numbers were beyond count, though Jellybean had a fair estimation. The 7-year-old had found her stomach aching at the sight of the seemingly endless march of the monsters, and her nerves jangled and tears were close as Eve hissed in her ear about killing and blood and what baked brains would taste like. She was trying to break Jellybean's mind. As a refuge, the little girl threw herself into the intricate dance that numbers unexpectedly revealed. Jellybean scrounged up paper and pens and began to explore math in a similar manner to how a person might take on the Rocky Mountains. She trudged her way uphill against the incomprehensible numbers through sheer will, her progress aided on some occasions by sudden intuitive leaps and on other occasions by Kay, who would explain various things such as the multiplication tables or long division. Then the way before her would suddenly open up, and there would be vistas of understanding as majestic as any mountain and as beautiful as any lush valley. It wasn't long before she could solve the simplest algebraic equations with barely a pause, and she was well down the path to learning the principles of superposition, though she had no idea of its official name, when the shooting from the west began to taper off. Everyone agreed that it was a portentous sign and that the end couldn't be long in coming. Everyone, including Eve, who pushed her way past the math and to the forefront of Jellybean's mind.
"Stupid Neil is dying," Eve said in a hissing whisper. "He's being eaten right now. Same with dumb old Sadie and all of them. They're being eaten alive. Aren't you glad we killed that ugly baby?" "Oh, shut up," Jellybean snapped. "Why, you should be happy we killed her. If we hadn't, she would be being eaten alive along with the rest of them right now. And wouldn't that be sad?" "I said zip it. I didn't kill her at all. It was you. And besides, you don't know what's going on up there."
Kay, who was sitting as far from Jellybean as possible, which, because of the handcuffs, was the seat next to her on the bus, gave her arm a jerk, yanking Jellybean halfway around.
"You're doing it again."
The woman got the heebie-jeebies whenever Jellybean spoke to Eve. It was a visible reaction. Her lip would curl, her eyebrows would drop into a line across the lower ridge of her forehead, and sometimes she would do a weird shimmy, as if a giant spider were walking up her spine.
"Sorry, I can't really help it,"
Jellybean said, not looking up. That wasn't exactly the truth. She could control Eve as long as she could control her fear. Just then she was afraid for her friends. The gradual decrease in the amount of gunfire from across the tips of the mountains most likely meant that the people of Colorado were being overwhelmed. She could picture them trapped in dark caves with mobs of the hateful monsters struggling to get in. This fear made Eve strong. Jellybean decided to refocus on the work she was doing. Eve hated math. It sent her sulking in some dark crevice of Jellybean's mind. Unfortunately, the evening was turning into a chill night, and there wasn't any light on the bus. She tried squinting at her papers, but couldn't make out anything besides a few scratchings on a white background.
Yep, they're all getting eaten now. Chomp, chomp, chomp,
Eve cackled. Now it was Jellybean's turn to get a shiver up her spine. She tried to force her mind away from the awful visions that were filling it, and was successful for a few hours. She was happily trying to calculate the number of monsters that had been drawn together in the Azael army when the bus door came open with a long metal creaking sound. All of the women on the bus sat up straight, as they had been trained to do, though not a one lifted their eyes from their laps. Only Jellybean, who considered herself way too young to be part of the adult things that were going on with the sad-looking women, dared to look up. It was a repetitive sight for her. Very tall men of the Azael were led onto the bus by the grizzled woman who was not only the bus driver but also the guard. The men would go down the aisle looking at the women, sometimes lifting their chins, sometimes opening their blouses. The women never seemed to breathe during these times. The bus would be stone quiet until one was picked and led away to the small pup tents that were set up on the ground next to the bus. Only then would there be a collective breath let out by the remaining women. This time was no different. It was one of the king's brothers who came in this time. Not many men were allowed to frequent the bus. Generally, only the royals with high ranks got to choose a woman. This big bearded duke went by the name of Baldwin. He had a vile reputation and a voracious sexual appetite. A number of the women began to shake as he strutted onto the bus.
"It's fun time," he said in a growly sort of voice.
He stood at the front of the bus, behind the white line, gazing up the rows with an ugly grin on his face. When he started advancing, Kay grabbed Jellybean's hands, their cuffs making a merry clinking sound as they shook. Baldwin stopped a step from them, and it was Jellybean he was looking at, with perverse lust in his eyes. This smote her well down into her soul, and there was an ensuing echo that caused her chest to hurt. What was he going to do with her? She had read, in the vague manner that dictionaries provided, what prostitutes do. They were sex workers who engaged in sexual relations in exchange for payment. She supposed being a prostitute was bad in some way, but she had never thought that it was dangerous. And yet, by the way the women were acting, Jellybean had every right to feel the fear blooming inside her.
"Has anyone gotten at you yet?" the Duke asked her.
Jellybean could only shake her head, not knowing exactly what was being asked of her. Next to her, Kay slid away to the far side of the little padded bench they shared. Jellybean looked over at her, but the woman was studiously staring forward. When the 7-year-old glanced back, she found the Duke leaning over her, one of his beefy paws on her skinny thigh.
"I'm not a prostitute," she stammered.
She didn't even know what sex was beyond the little the dictionary had told her. A means of procreation. It was how babies were made, but she was too young, and she wasn't married. Only mommies and daddies made babies, not little girls. Everyone knew that.
"Well, you got to do something around here, and it doesn't seem like we're going to need that big brain of yours."
He seemed to be correct in this. The gunfire coming from the Estes Valley had petered into nothing 2 hours before. Any logical reading of that sign would point to the complete destruction of the Colorado Army.
"You're going to have to earn your keep another way."
The hand on her thigh tightened until it hurt.
"I'm only 7,
she gasped, unable to think of anything else.
"Tell him if he touches us, I'll cut off his balls,"
Eve said. The evil girl inside of her wasn't actually angry. She was looking forward to what was going to happen. She knew it would be her ticket to control of their shared body.
7. Sounds like a perfect time to start training you.
Baldwin put out his hand, and Jellybean was forced to put her tiny one in it, as though he were her daddy.
"He is not daddy,"
Eve raged, growing stronger.
"I'll kill him! I'll cut off—"
Her rant was cut short as Jellybean was caught up suddenly. Baldwin had tugged her along so quickly that Kay hadn't had time to pick up the 25-pound dumbbell to which she was handcuffed.
"What the fuck?"
the Duke growled.
"I'm sorry, I don't have the key,"
Kay whined as she struggled with the weight. Baldwin's lip curled at Kay's battered face, and then he muttered a curse as he saw the handcuffs. Jellybean thought he was going to explode in anger, but after a moment he shrugged and his features relaxed slightly. He said to Kay,
"If you're going to come along, you might as well give the girl some pointers."
Kay blanched, unable to hide her look of disgust.
"You want me to come with you? You want me to—"
She seemed unable to go on.
"Yeah, and don't piss me off or you won't have any teeth left after I get through with you."
"Yes, sir,"
Kay said, and then hefted her dumbbell. She pushed Jellybean ahead of her in a rush and was only slowed by the stairs of the bus, which were difficult to manage. Handcuffed as they were, and with the fact that Jellybean found her legs practically giving out on her, Duke Baldwin was going to do something to her, something bad judging by the reaction of the other women on the bus. She feared that he was going to put a baby inside of her. She was too small for a baby. She would be split wide open by it, and her guts would pour out onto the dirt. The thought had her going limp, and, as Kay was in an awkward position with the heavy weight, they both toppled off the last step to land on the shoulder of the road where the gravel bit into their hands. Kay cried out since the handcuffs on the dumbbell had already chafed away a good deal of skin, and the remainder split and began to bleed. This infuriated Baldwin, who raised a hand to strike the woman, yet the blow did not fall. Just then there came a loud rumble from out of the west. With his hand still raised, Baldwin turned to stare in the direction of the sound. Seconds later, there came a flash of light from over the mountain. It lit up the darkness and was followed seconds later by the roar of an explosion that bounced along the rock walls of the highway.
"That can't be," Baldwin said.
"What is it?"
Reluctantly, and with a fading voice, Eve answered,
"Artillery."
The explosions continued, lighting up the sky and dimming the stars. The sex slaves on the bus were much encouraged by it. They crowded to one side of the bus and stared out, wearing broad grins as if they were kids watching a fireworks show. Even Baldwin was caught staring. His brother Menace came hobbling out of the dark.
"What the fuck is this?"
he demanded. Baldwin jerked in surprise.
"Huh? Menace, is that you? I was just...
He turned and pointed at Kay and Jellybean, his mouth opening and closing like a landed trout as he tried to think of something to say. Eventually, he came up with,
"I was bringing them to see you. I figured you'd want to see the girl."
Menace looked into the frightened eyes of Jellybean. What he saw there, she didn't know. He was slow in answering.
"I do. I knew we were celebrating a bit prematurely. Help them up. We should be with Augustus."
Jellybean was lifted to her feet by Baldwin. His grip on her arm was hard as iron. There was a warning look in his eyes. He didn't want her to say anything about what had almost happened. With a final, harder pinch, he let go and repeated the same process with Kay.
"K,
Keep her quiet,
Duke Baldwin whispered to Kay. She nodded back.
She'll be quiet, I promise.
Jellybean didn't know what she was supposed to be quiet about. She could be as quiet as anyone, except for maybe Captain Gray, who could walk through broken glass without making a sound. But was she supposed to be quiet about nearly being forced into being a sex worker? There was no way she would, except who was she going to tell? Menace didn't seem to care about her at all. He only wanted to use her. That was true for the king as well. Kay was supposed to be her friend, but she was so very chicken that it was hard to tell.
Don't trust any of them,
Eve said. Before Jellybean could whisper a no duh, the voice in her head went on.
Find a way to kill them.
The thought rattled her, because there wasn't any good reason why she shouldn't kill them. For once, she had to agree with Eve, and Jellybean thought it a very bad sign. Despite his wounded ankle, Duke Menace could get along very quickly on his crutches. The king had his tent 50 yards away, and Menace beat Baldwin, Kay, and Jellybean there by 10 yards. The king's tent was a long and tall, white affair, something like a tent to host outdoor parties in. Before it roared a bonfire. With the monsters all pushed up the valley, the king and his brothers and a number of beautiful women sat around it, completely safe.
Just in time to see the show, my brothers, Duke Paulus said.
He was smiling, but he was the only one. Everyone else had been hoping that the zombies had done the hard work for them. The king had brought his grand damask-covered chair with him to the battlefield, and now it was close enough to the fire for him to roast meat over the flames. Everyone else sat on folding chairs and seemed so much smaller and insignificant than the king. He coughed up something, chewed it for a second, and then spat it into the fire where it hissed. Augustus waited for the hissing to die away before saying,
Just get on with it.
Of course, Paulus said. We just have to wait on the computer to do its thing. This isn't easy, you know. There's a lot of high-tech gadgetry involved. For instance, there are 2 radars set up on those 2 peaks. He pointed up at 2 tall hills. They feed data into the tracking computer, and that allows us to triangulate the position of the enemy artillery.
Will it work?
Augustus demanded.
That's all I want to know.
Paulus' smile dimmed slightly.
Yes. My man and I tested it 1 month ago. It was... Wait, I have a green light.
He turned to look down the road where the 155-millimeter howitzers were parked. With the dark and the distance, they were only strange, needle-nosed machines to Jellybean.
On my mark,
Paulus said into a radio, speaking with much importance.
3, 2, 1, fire!
A great orange blast of flame erupted from the muzzles of the howitzers. It was a blinding strobe light that had Jellybean trying to blink away bright blobs from her vision. Everyone around the fire sat quietly with their heads cocked as they listened for the distant explosions. When the rumble came to them, they broke into grins.
Reload,
Paulus ordered into the radio. He looked at his watch, and when 30 seconds had passed, he said,
On my mark. 3, 2, 1, fire!
Again, the dark was interrupted by a flash and a blast of sound. Again, everyone listened, and when the sound came this time, they cheered.
You better give them 1 more round,
Augustus told his brother,
just to be on the safe side.
Paulus was only too happy to obey. When he had gone through the sequence and the air shook and more people died in the valley, and there was only silence from the west, the Azael clapped their hands. Paulus bowed to his brother the king and said,
Now that I have destroyed their artillery, they will be helpless against us. Whatever walls they have left, I can blow to smithereens. They will be at our mercy.
My mercy, I think you mean,
Augustus said. Again, Paulus bowed.
Of course, my brother and my king.
It is your mercy that they will have to rely on, because I will rain fire down on their heads. By noon tomorrow, my artillery will wipe away all opposition, and the Stiffs will flood that valley. The soldiers will have no choice but to run or hide.
Noon?
Menace asked with an air of innocence.
Why not blast them away now?
A twitch turned part of Paula's smile down, but only for a second.
Because my spotters need to be able to see their targets. I guess they didn't teach you this in school, Menace, but radar works on the principle of line of sight. It can't see through mountains.
There was general laughter at this, to which Menace smiled dangerously. When Paulus started going on about what a stroke of genius it had been of his to bring the artillery, and how he was even then ready to send his spotters out so that they could be in position at first light, Menace bent down and whispered in Jellybean's ear,
"Why won't this work?"
Surprised at the question, Jellybean could only shrug her slim shoulders.
"It will work. I know what explosions are and what bombs are. If there are walls, a bomb will blow them up."
"That's all you have for me?"
Menace asked icily.
"You are here only because of your brains. You had better use them, or I will find another use for you. One you won't care for."
The threat proved valuable. Jellybean's mind clicked into overdrive as she examined the variables before her. Artillery, targets, spotters, explosions, and walls. The most obvious reason why Paulus' plan wouldn't work was that his artillery could miss their targets.
"That's what spotters are for, stupid head,"
Eve said in her usual unhelpful manner. No other answer came to mind. Experience had taught her that no wall was strong enough to stop bombs. Paulus' plan would work unless... Jellybean had simply thrown the unless in there since her future rested on finding one. There had to be an unless. She stepped around Duke Menace so that the fire was behind her and she could see down the road a bit. The king had halted his human army well back. There were thousands of them, some in the bright armor that Brad Crane wore, but most were dressed in the mad swirl of the multi-hued scarves. Strangely, none wore the camouflage that Captain Gray was always uniformed in. Right away, she saw that was an enormous mistake on their part. Their scarf outfits were good enough to fool the monsters, but against the soldiers of the valley, the Azael would be ideal targets.
"Excuse me, Mr. Duke Paulus, sir,"
Jellybean said, breaking in on the king's brother as he spoke at length. At first, he glared. However, there was still enough of the old mores left in the group that it seemed impolite to be harsh to a little girl when she was as cute as Jellybean was. Displaying a faux fatherly air, he asked,
"Yes?"
"Can I ask where your spotters are?"
Now Paulus let his sneer show.
"What's that to you?"
"Because..."
She paused to glance up at Menace.
"I think I see a mistake in your plan."
Menace stepped up next to her quickly.
"A mistake?"
he asked with surprise.
"Are you sure?"
Yeah,
she answered uncertainly. Hadn't the Duke asked her to find a problem?
"I think so, Mr. Duke, sir. If the spotters are you Azael guys, they'll be dressed in the scarves, and the army guys will be dressed as bushes, you see? The army guys from the valley are super good shots. Captain Gray, he was this real brave man who helped us out sometimes. He was a real good shooter. He could kill a monster from, like, a mile away. And he's real smart, too. He knows all about bombs and artillery. He's going to guess right where your spotters are going to be, and then..."
She mimicked being shot in the heart. Duke Menace clapped Jellybean on the shoulder and gave her a warm squeeze. The rest of the people around the fire checked the enthusiasm they'd been displaying and turned to Paulus with questioning eyes.
"We have camo, too," Paulus declared. "We'll have them decked out. It'll be no problem."
The king spat again into the fire, sending up a wisp of smoke and another fresh sizzle.
"Camo won't cut it with these guys."
He gazed up at the peaks for a moment before adding, "If I was them, I'd be sending men up there right now. They aren't stupid, Paulus."
"Maybe it's a chance we have to take," countered Paulus. "Casualties of war and all that."
The king ground his teeth at this, and his stare was as hot as the fire.
"I expect casualties, but we don't throw away men uselessly. We either send 1,000 men up there or we don't send any at all. And it's way too early in the game for something like that."
"I can send a company up to each," Paulus began, but the king stomped his foot in the dirt, quieting him.
"This fight isn't going to be about who controls the peaks. A fight like that plays right into their hands. It's where they excel. They'll see your men coming a mile away."
"Son of a bitch.
We need to fight our fight. And part of that means using our zombie army to its utmost, which means we need to break down their walls. Any suggestions?"
His dark eyes went right to Jillybean, and her soft, downy brows lifted slightly. Was he expecting her to dictate the direction of his battle for him? When no one else said or did anything besides examine the tops of their shoes or follow the licking flames jumping off the bonfire, she said,
"You can still use the guns. You just have to..."
She stopped suddenly as she realized what she was doing. She was giving her enemies the means to kill her friends. That wasn't right. It was far from right. Having started the sentence, she couldn't exactly leave it unfinished. She wanted to say something really smart-alecky to cover her slip. However, nothing came to mind.
"You can tell them to shove the guns up their asses and pull the triggers,"
Eve suggested. Jillybean blushed at the suggestion. The king glowered as he waited for an answer.
"Well, what do we have to do?"
Ideas failed her, but not her courage.
"You can shove those guns up your asses and pull the triggers."
The sentence had started loud enough, but had finished only slightly louder than a whisper. The king's glare had turned ferocious.
"Maybe it's time we remind her who's in charge here," the king said.
He snapped his fingers and pointed at Kay. The woman folded at the knees and immediately began begging. She was wasting her breath. The Azael understood pain and screams. Begging only egged them on. As Brad rushed forward with murder in his eyes, Jillybean steeled herself for what was to come. They would test her by hurting Kay, and maybe herself. None of that should matter, she told herself. There were more lives at stake than theirs. Just as she expected, Brad almost gleefully began to beat Kay. He swung his fists without mercy, and soon blood was flying.
I'm so sorry,
Jillybean said to Kay. She wanted more than anything to run away, but they were handcuffed together. The best she could do was turn her head away, and she was in a perfect position to see the king roll his eyes.
Give the girl a whack, he said. Just don't ruin her sales value.
Jillybean turned to Brad just as he swung his hand. He wasn't gentle. The open-handed blow struck her flush on the cheek. Her head rocked back and her eyes were pinned to the dark sky above. Another blow struck her, but she could barely feel it. She was falling into the black, and then a voice was speaking. It was a high child's voice.
"Is that all you got? You hit like a pussy."
It was Eve. She was back in charge. Chapter 10. Jillybean.
Brad Crane smacked her again, but Eve only grinned through the blood.
"Pussy,"
she hissed, daring him on. He struck her again, harder, and Jellybean's body reeled along a short curve defined by the length of her and Kay's arms. She toppled onto the highway, and again she found herself staring up at the black. Eve's mind spun in a vast circle with the dust of the Milky Way in its center. For a moment, no one was in control of their shared body, and Jellybean was able to jump back in, though why she wanted to was beyond her. Her mind was a seesaw, and her soul held all the rhythm and music of a cowbell. Her head ached and her face felt raw. Next to her, Kay was nothing but a ball of quivering flesh and a mat of black hair covered in blood and tears.
"Now the other one," Augustus said.
Jellybean felt instant relief that she wasn't going to be hit again, which gave way to the pain of guilt. Brad punched Kay for all he was worth. She begged in the shrill cry of a dying hog, not for Brad to stop, but for Jellybean to tell them what they wanted to know.
"No,"
Jellybean said in a whisper. She was able to get to her knees, but that was all. Her muscles were jittery, and the tears on her red cheeks were like diamonds in the firelight.
I can't. Two lives are meaningless. You can kill us both,"
she dared the king.
"Don't listen to her,"
screeched Kay at the top of her lungs. This seemed almost a catalyst for Brad's volcanic anger. He started stomping on Kay. His knees would piston up and then shoot down. On his feet were cowboy boots with 2-inch heels. They came down with such force that Kay could no longer scream. She could only grunt from the blows. Jellybean, though attached to the woman by handcuffs, stoically looked away. She wished with all her might that she was far away, miles away. Jellybean felt every blow the woman suffered as if she was the one being tortured, and still she did not relent. Finally, the king put up a hand. Brad stopped at once.
"Empty the bus. Tie up the girls and bring them here. We'll see how many lives it will take for this girl to agree to talk."
In a flash, Jellybean calculated the number of women on the bus. An average of 2 per row, times 16 rows. She didn't know enough math to carry numbers. She could only break it down into sets. 2 tens were 20. Added to this was 2 sixes, which she knew to be 12, a sum of 32. The number staggered the little girl.
"You might as well give up," Eve said. "There is no way you can watch 32 women beaten to death in front of you. You'll give in, you'll talk, you'll betray your friends, and you'll never see them alive again. And I'll take over. You'll be mine. You should give in now and let me have the body. I know what to do with it."
A sudden image of Jellybean gleefully slitting the king's throat came to her. It made her want to puke. It made her want to faint, and again the night spun. Her head dropped and her flyaway brown hair hung before her face so that no one saw the look of victory in Eve's blue eyes as a smile suddenly broke across her face. Jellybean had weakened, and now Eve was back.
"Stop,"
Eve said as she stood. The word carried all the force of a royal order. Brad turned back to stare at her, expectantly. Everyone around the fire had the same look. She loved how they looked to her, how they needed her. She wanted to prolong the moment, but she could already feel Jellybean fighting back.
"You can't dress in scarves,"
she said, looking pointedly at Paulus.
"They'll kill you easily, and you can't go up to the peaks. They'll expect it, and then they'll kill you."
"Right," Paulus insisted. "You said that already."
Eve's eyes flared up at the interruption. She had a sudden desire to throw him into the fire and watch him burn.
The picture in her mind almost distracted her enough for Jellybean to take over again. Quickly, she said,
"Your only chance is to have your spotter mix in with the monsters. You can get in close, but only if you dress like them and act like them and be them."
This wild statement caused a muttering to spring up around the fire. It included everyone except Kay, who lay on the ground a foot from Jellybean, crying softly, and Brad, who was staring at the little girl with cold calculation in his eyes, and of course, Duke Menace. Menace had seen Jellybean the night the renegades had made their escape. The little girl had been dressed in the mud and rags of her monster outfit.
"It is the only way to get close," Menace acknowledged.
Paulus threw his hands in the air, crying,
"Are you crazy? What she's saying is suicide, and it's stupid. Weren't we just talking about not wasting men unnecessarily?"
"Not so fast, Paulus," Augustus said.
He was eyeing his brother and Brad Crane. These two were wearing nearly the same calculating expressions.
"Is this possible? Does this fool the stiffs?"
"I've seen it for myself," Menace said.
Brad raised a hand that was wet with Kay's blood. "And I'll bet my life that it'll work. I'll go amongst the dead with the radio and direct the artillery." This raised eyebrows all around in what was a comical display, almost as if they were a group of bad actors overdoing a scene. Eve didn't have an opportunity to laugh at them. The shared mind was teetering against her. Enraged at the treachery, Jellybean fought her way back into control. It was like waking up from a bad dream, except her reality was just as bad. For the moment, she was an afterthought, and no one noticed her chest rising and falling as she panted like a dog. Nor did they see the wild, uncertain look in her eyes. She wanted to run away from her guilt. She wanted to run away from her life. Unfortunately, that wasn't an option.
"You won't be able to do it," she said to Brad. "You're not smart enough. You have to be stealthy. That's what means extra sneaky. You're too loud. They'll get you."
"They'll get us, you mean," Brad replied. "I plan on taking you with me."
This brought on another general stir of surprise from the onlookers, who were treating what was going on like a soap opera.
"You'll come with me. You'll do what I say, and you will behave, or else I will set the bus on fire with all those women in it. Do you understand?"
The idea appealed to Eve. She could picture the flames swamping the vehicle, pouring up its sides as though it was a perverse liquid that could defy the laws of gravity. She could hear the roar of the flames, and beneath that, the utter despair of the women as they burned to death. She grinned at the prospect, and Jellybean found herself grinning as well. Her mind was coming unbalanced again. Disgusted, the little girl stuffed Eve away, which was sort of like crushing down on the lid of a garbage can that was overflowing with refuse. The imagined screams kept on echoing until she shook her head.
"Okay,"
Jellybean said to Brad.
"I'll do it. Just don't hurt anyone."
Brad grinned, but made no promises. He unlocked the handcuffs from Kay's wrist and then kicked the woman one last time.
"Go back to the bus, and don't even think about trying to run away."
In the dark, she could have run. However, Brad did not err in his judgment of the woman. The beatings had cowed her into a sniveling servility, and she went to the bus without a glance left or right. Neither Jellybean nor Eve could understand this. Kay was under no duress. The lives of an entire busload of people weren't yoked on her shoulders. She could have walked away and have been halfway to Denver by the time the sun came up.
"Pathetic,"
Eve whispered, and Jellybean had to agree. As Jellybean was watching Kay walk away, Duke Menace grabbed her by the shoulders and pulled her around to face the king.
"Do we have your permission to undertake this mission, Your Highness?"
The king glanced once at Paulus before nodding. When the youngest brother began to splutter, Augustus slapped his hand down on the arm of his great chair.
"You shouldn't be angry, Paulus. You should be thanking Menas for having the foresight to bring this little girl along. Without her, I think it is safe to say, it would have been a waste of time and resources to haul these guns all the way up here."
"What about the counter-battery fire?" Paulus demanded. "They were worth it, right?"
"Enough,"
Augustus said, cutting him off in mid-sentence. Dismissively, the king turned from his brother to look at Brad.
"Why are you still here, Crane? Get your ass in gear."
Brad bowed and then dragged Jellybean away. When they were out of earshot, he began to grumble.
"Why are you still here, Crane?"
he mimicked in falsetto.
"Geez, what an asshole."
"That's a bad word,"
Jellybean reminded him.
"But since you're bad yourself, it doesn't matter."
"Shut your mouth," Brad said after a quick look down at her, "or I'll tape it shut."
She was quiet as they marched down the road to where the big guns were erected. In the dark, they resembled towering insects from an alien world. Jellybean looked upon them with some trepidation. They had belched so much fire when they had gone off that she was sure that if they went off again with her so close, her hair would get burned right off. As Brad got instructions on how to work the radio and what was to be expected of him as a spotter, Jellybean stood nearby, touching her face where Brad had hit her. Something didn't feel right. Her head felt lumpy and swollen, and her nose was way bigger than it was supposed to be. She remembered what Kay looked like after her beating, and Jellybean was afraid she looked the same way.
"That's why we need to kill him,"
Eve said. Jellybean glanced over at Brad, who was talking to the captain of the guns. The captain was a tall, rangy man, with hair as long as a woman's, and tattoos like some sort of green-tinted skin disease that seemed to grow up from his chest to strangle his neck. Neither he nor Brad seemed to have heard Eve's remark. The little girl turned away and whispered,
"We can't kill him. Think about what will happen to all those ladies on the bus." "Who cares about a bunch of whores?"
Eve demanded.
"You should be thinking about the greater good. What about Neil and Captain Gray and all of them?" "But you hate them,"
Jellybean cried.
"You're the one who keeps stabbing them in the back over and over. It was your fault that..."
Brad suddenly appeared at her side. He gave her a shove that sent her to her knees.
"Shut up," he snapped. "While you're with me, you need to keep your crazy yapping in check. Do you hear me?"
Jellybean nodded sullenly. The idea of killing Brad was now quite appealing. She guessed that the disgusting desire to hurt him stemmed from Eve, but there was no way to know for sure, and she didn't question it either way. Brad was a very bad person, and she thought that he needed to come to a bad end.
"But not yet,"
she thought. She still had to worry about the poor ladies on the bus. She also had to worry about Captain Gray and Mr. Neil and her sister Sadie, but just not as much. They were strong and smart and fast. They could take care of themselves, even with a big monster attack going on. Brad thanked the gun captain and, carrying a heavy brick-sized radio in his hand, he directed Jellybean back the way they had come. All along the road they passed groups of strange men. In the dark, they were scary shadows to Jellybean, shadows that talked in low voices and laughed in whispers. Many had the glowing embers of cigarettes dangling from their lips, which only added to the aura of wickedness that hung in the air around them. A few watched Jellybean as she passed, their eyes filled with the same perverse desire that she had seen in Baldwin's eyes. As odious as Brad was, she stayed very close to him, and would have reached out to take his hand if she dared. His mood kept her from making the attempt. He was no longer the amiable liar who had steered them in circles around the state of Kansas. He was curt of speech, coldly determined, and quick to anger. He marched them to another tent that was pitched up next to an army deuce and a half, and swept inside. The light blinded Jellybean for a few seconds. However, she didn't need her eyes to know who was in the tent.
"If it isn't His Royal Highness," a man said.
Jellybean knew instantly that it was Duke Menace Quartermaster. She knew him only as Jim. On the day that the renegades had escaped from the Duke, she had followed him and Brad into the theater where all of the Duke's ordnance had been housed. She could have blown it all sky high, but she had opted to buy the renegades time to get away instead.
"Shut it,"
Brad said, his anger right on the edge of getting out of his control. With the escape of the renegades coupled with the loss of a dozen men at McConnell Air Force Base, Duke Menace had been in no mood to bestow titles on anyone. Brad Crane was not yet Baron Crane, as he had expected. Jim bent into a mocking bow before waving his hand at the tent, which was crowded with supplies of all sorts, the majority of it being ammunition, but there was also a crate of C4 and, much to Jellybean's chagrin, radio-controlled detonators. She hadn't been able to find any the last time she had searched the munitions storage facility back in the theater.
"What can I do for you at this late hour?"
Jim glanced briefly at Jellybean before adding,
"Do you need a crib?"
"I'm not a baby, Mr. Jim,"
Jellybean said. Jim's face registered surprise at hearing his name. He glanced at Brad.
"How the hell does she know my name?"
Brad also looked at Jellybean with an odd eye, but then he shrugged, saying,
"I don't really care how she knows. I need some supplies for a trip, that length of chain for one."
Among the boxes of clothing and the crates of ammo and the stacks of MREs, there were many oddities, including rope, tools, tarps, and 10 feet of half-inch chain. Jim gave Brad an odd look, but handed it over. The odd look deepened when Brad wrapped one end of it around Jellybean's neck, attaching it snugly using a pair of handcuffs as a locking mechanism.
"I won't run away,"
Jellybean told him as she tugged on the chain. For the little girl, the chain was uncomfortably heavy. Plus, she knew that where they were going, being chained in any manner could be deadly.
"I promise I won't."
"Come on, Brad, she promised,"
Jim said with a smirk. Brad glared at the quartermaster and muttered,
"Shut the fuck up. Now, Jellybean, what are we going to need?"
"To fool the monsters? Not much of this stuff unless we can have some of those shirty things."
Jim looked behind him at where she was pointing.
"The ponchos? Sure, you can have some ponchos, but I'm afraid they aren't very good at monster fooling. But they are good if it rains, which it probably won't. But who knows, I ain't no weather forecaster or nothing. It could rain."
"It's not for the rain,"
Jellybean said, grinning at how silly Jim was being.
"They're for camel,
Brad, who had hold of the other end of the chain, gave it a yank.
"He doesn't need to know what they're for," he snapped. "Now, anything else?"
Normally, she would have made do with mud to turn her pale complexion into something that no longer resembled a little girl's soft skin. However, there were some camo sticks in a box, the sort Captain Gray had used when they first met him. Meekly, she pointed to them. Jim followed her finger, saw what she wanted, and reached for them. As he did, Jellybean noticed something else that she needed. There was a stack of forms on a box right next to Jim. Within the papers, there were a number of paperclips that could be used to unlock the unnecessary collar around her neck. As Jim reached for the camo sticks and Brad went to the unkempt pile of ponchos, Jellybean reached out and slapped the paperwork off the box. As she expected, the papers went everywhere. She followed them with a sharper eye than any adult would have given her credit for. She knew exactly where the paperclips landed.
"I'm sorry,"
she said, going to her knees and grabbing handfuls of paper. Right next to her hand gleamed a clip. She slid her hand over it, and just as she did, Jim was suddenly there. He saw what her hand landed on. She had been caught right off the bat.
"I...
Nothing else made it out of her throat. She was not good at lying, especially when it seemed useless. There was no denying what she was doing. She had been caught as red-handed as she could be. Jim glanced up at the sour look on Brad's face. When he looked back at the little girl, he said nothing. He only shrugged and acted as though he hadn't seen anything. This minuscule touch of kindness deep in the camp of her enemies was almost enough to overcome her. Before she knew it, tears were in her eyes, threatening to come splashing out, threatening to alert Brad that something was afoot. Jim widened his eyes, giving her a warning not to overreact.
"Stupid girl," Jim growled, making a big show of gathering up the papers.
When he had them stacked well enough, he tossed Brad the camo sticks and then went to the ponchos and held two of them up for Brad to see.
"All I have is large and extra large. Are you expecting a monsoon?"
"Give me one of each," Brad snarled. The second they were handed over, Brad hustled Jilly Bean out of the tent before she could say a proper goodbye. He kept one hand on the chain and the other on her back as he guided her down the road to a spot where they were somewhat alone. He made a show of looking all around so as not to be overheard.
"So how does this work? You can't just fool the stiffs by dressing weird, can you?"
"I don't know about dressing weird, but I know that if you don't look human exactly, they'll leave you alone. Oh, and you can't talk, neither. Really, the more you look and act like a monster, the better. And you have to moan, too. There aren't any quiet monsters. They all say stuff, you know, or meh, stuff like that."
That works?"
His question made no sense to Jilly Bean.
"Not just you have to do it all. You know, the walk and the arms and the look. The monsters are real dumb, but they're not that dumb. They'll sniff you out if you don't do it all at once. Really, there's only one way to get it right."
"And that is?"
Jilly Bean wanted to laugh at the silly question, but Brad still had the dangerous look about him.
"You have to practice, of course."
He seemed as though he was going to balk at the suggestion, but abruptly he shrugged and allowed her to teach him everything she knew about how to be a monster. There really wasn't all that much to it beyond the big three: having the right costume, staying in character, and being brave. This last was what tripped up most people. Any display of nerves was generally a dead giveaway to the monsters. Brad displayed a talent for mimicry, and his costume, a muddled-up face and a shredded poncho, was weak, but good enough. The only thing left was to practice with real zombies. Only Brad argued that they didn't have time. He explained they had 4 hours to cover 10 miles of mountainous and zombie-filled land. The first 2 miles zipped by as Brad commandeered a 4x4 truck. They drove it up the winding highway until they came to a group of men sitting around a fire. Off to the side of the road, hitched to the guardrail, was a row of 20 horses, each chomping oats out of nose bags. Jilly Bean wanted more than anything to go pet the horses. However, she knew better than to try. Brad was completely mission-oriented.
"Who's in charge?" Brad asked.
One of the men held up a hand.
"I am Baron Graves. What do you want?"
Like all of them, he wore armor like a knight. It caught the orange glow of the fire and seemed to burn from within.
"I need a horse," Brad answered. "A fresh one, preferably with a good nimble step."
When Graves opened his mouth, Brad answered his question before he asked it.
"King's orders. How much further until things jam up?"
Graves pulled a stick from the fire and pointed up the highway with the lit end.
"A mile or so."
The answer caught Brad by surprise.
"That's it? 1 mile? We've had contact for 6 hours. Why aren't they further along?"
"Who knows?" Graves said with a shrug.
"Our job is to herd the stiffs up the highway. Who knows what's stopping them? My guess is that the soldier boys don't want to get eaten and are putting up a fight. Big surprise, right? What are you going to do with one of my horses?"
"Take it to Estes," was the simple answer.
"Someone has to spot for the artillery."
This caused heads to shake and a few chuckles.
"You're going on a horse?" Graves asked. "That's suicide. They'll see you from a mile away and put a hole in your head like that."
He snapped his fingers. It was a dry sound, like a twig cracking.
"That's a chance I have to take," Brad replied. "Now, let's have that horse."
No one asked about Jellybean. They gave her and the chain she wore around her neck questioning looks, but as Brad was in a sour mood and in a hurry to go, no one said anything. In no time, the pair was mounted on a great black beast of a horse. Jellybean felt as if she were 10 feet in the air. She sat in front of Brad and was able to run her fingers through the horse's mane, and she was able to touch the surprisingly hard muscles of its neck. She was even able to talk to it, at least at first. When they had trekked upwards for the mile that separated the drover's camp from the main host of zombies, she was forced to say,
"What a good boy,"
one last time, and then she threw the hood of the poncho over her head and became just a silent green blob. In front of them, stretching as far as the eye could see, were approximately 250,000 zombies. It was a mind-boggling display. They filled the highway from end to end, and then overlapped it and filled both shoulders of the road. Behind them, in a single line, were 20 more of the drovers on horseback. They were tired men. They sat in their saddles with their backs bent and their long spears carried listlessly. Normally, they used the spears to drive the zombies on, but it was clear, even to Jellybean, that the zombies weren't going anywhere. They were pressed into the gorge cut through the mountains with little room to even breathe. Brad wanted to take them right into the stinking mass. It seemed utterly impossible. He gave a low whistle to the drovers, who parted for him, and then clopped his way right past. One of them cursed in amazement.
"Motherfucker!"
Another whispered,
"Don't do it, man."
Undeterred, Brad aimed the horse square into the middle of the pack, and, at the same plodding rate, they plunged into the horde. The zombies were thrust aside by the massive beast, and in seconds they were in the thick of things. Even though she was so high up, Jellybean pulled her legs in towards her. She had never been in the midst of such an ungodly host. Ugly, rotting heads turned in their direction, teeth champed in hunger, and evil eyes watched them, looking for any sign of humanity. Even her brave heart was unnerved by being so utterly surrounded by the walking dead. Brad gave no indication that he was in the least bit nervous. He steered the horse expertly through the throng, and it plowed ahead like a battleship cutting up a small river. It was hard going for the animal, and many times it staggered as one hoof or another came down awkwardly on one of the zombies. When this happened, Jellybean's heart would leap into her throat. However, the horse was indeed sure-footed. It was a long uphill journey for both man and beast. They trudged through the mob for 3 hours until the horse began to stumble in weariness, and Jellybean was just about to faint from the sickening stench rising from the corpses. Brad steered them to one of the softer hills shooting up all around them. It rose gradually and bristled with a young pine forest. A few zombies were on its slope, perhaps 100. Not many, in Jellybean's opinion, and yet there were enough to cause Brad's courage to falter.
"Ah, shit,"
he whispered. The horse had gone 30 feet up the hill and just plain stopped. Its legs shook, and it breathed in a wheeze. It was finished as a mount, which meant they had to dismount under the watchful eyes of the zombies.
"Do exactly what I do,"
Jellybean whispered. She began to moan. Ever so slowly, so as not to betray her humanity, she brought one foot around, twisted in the saddle, and then slid down the horse's withers to plop down in the wet leaves. She went on moaning.
and only gradually did she try to stand. With the dark and the shredded poncho and the hood, it was hard to tell what she was, and the zombies barely gave her much of a glance. Now it was Brad's turn.
"Ugh,"
he said in what was practically a bellow. It was too loud and too short of a sound, and the way he swung his leg over the pommel was far too human. Jellybean had stepped away from the side of the horse until the chain at her throat had stopped her. Now she took a willing step back, saying,
"Ugh,"
the way a zombie was supposed to sound. Brad gave her a quick and altogether human look.
"Ugh,"
she said again, and let her head hang and her eyes loll listlessly in their sockets so that nothing was exactly in focus. He seemed to catch her meaning.
"Ugh,"
he said more accurately this time. He came down off the horse and landed in a crouched ball. The zombies all around stared at him, as if waiting for him to jump up and betray himself as human.
"Ah,"
Jellybean encouraged. None of the zombies batted an eye at her. Even the chain around her neck was strange enough not to be considered human. Brad waited in his crouch, and Jellybean guessed he was waiting for the monsters to turn away, but she knew that they wouldn't unless acted upon by an outside force.
"Ah,"
she tried again. Finally, Brad got the idea.
"Ah,"
he said. From then on, things went a little more smoothly. After surreptitiously looping the horse's bridle around a branch that Brad pretended to stumble against, the two humans slowly made their way up the hill. There were zombies all the way to the top, though there were fewer with each step up.